and Johnson walked in behind him. The chamber, bright in the glare of television lights, was jammed. Every seat taken. In the galleries above, people jammed even on the steps in the aisles. In the presidential box, Lady Bird and his daughters, the family retainers, Zephyr and Sammy Wright, and the others he had placed there, Mayors Wagner and Daley and Governors Lawrence and Sanders, and liberal symbol Schlesinger. In the press gallery, photographers elbowing each other for a better angle for their bulky cameras. Sitting in the front rows below the dais were the black-robed Supreme Court justices, the bemedaled joint chiefs, ambassadors of foreign nations, and the cabinet. Robert Kennedy, gaunt and wan, was sitting at the end of the cabinet row staring at the floor. As Johnson walked down the center aisle, his face set and unsmiling, and went up to the dais and opened the notebook for the speech on which so much depended. "All I have I would have given gladly not to be standing here today," he began. The sentence was eloquent, sorrowful. A hush fell over the chamber, the hush of hundreds of men and women, so intent on a speaker's words that they barely moved. "The greatest leader of our time has been struck down by the foulest deed of our time," he said. "Today John Fitzgerald Kennedy lives on in the immortal words and works that he left behind. He lives on in the mind and memories of mankind. He lives on in the hearts of his countrymen." The next lines on the page in front of Lyndon Johnson were, "No words are sad enough to express our sense of loss. No words are strong enough to express our determination to continue the forward thrust of America that he began." But the words, as Johnson spoke them, did express that sense and that determination because of the way he spoke them. So slowly, with a deep, grave dignity behind them, that they seemed to reverberate across the rows of listeners before him and above him. He stood erect behind the rostrum, in dark blue suit and tie, a tall, strong figure, and there was an air of command in the way his big head turned from side to side as he spoke, taking in the chamber, his dark eyes intense behind the rimless glasses. And when he spoke of determination and the need to thrust forward, so caught up was he in what he was saying that his head and shoulders thrust forward, as if his entire body was pounding home the words, his eyes narrowing, his jaw jutting, and his lips tightening into a straight, grim line in an expression the senators below him remembered from another time. The expression of a Lyndon Johnson determined to win. The audience broke into applause. He defined the dreams that Kennedy had vitalized by his drive and by his dedication. The dream of conquering space, the dream of partnership across the Atlantic and across the Pacific as well, the dream of a Peace Corps, the dream of education for all of our children. He would carry on the fight for those dreams, he said. Now the ideas and the ideals which he so nobly represented must and will be translated into effective action. America will keep its commitments from South Vietnam to West Berlin, he said. And then he arrived at the paragraphs that picked up on Kennedy's inaugural phrase. On the 20th day of January in 1961, John F. Kennedy told his countrymen that our national work would not be finished in the first 1,000 days, nor in the life of this administration, nor even, perhaps, in our lifetime on this planet. But, he said, let us begin. Johnson paused, and there was the thrust of his head again and the narrowed eyes, narrowed almost into slits, and the stern hard mouth and the jaw jabbing out as he said, "Today, in this moment of new resolve, I would say to all my fellow Americans, let us continue." "This is our challenge," Johnson said, "not to hesitate, not to pause, not to turn about and linger over this evil moment, but to continue on in our course, so that we may fulfill the destiny that history has set for us." "Pause, pause," Johnson had written at that point. He would have had to do that anyway, because of the applause. When he resumed, he said that, "Our most immediate tasks are here on this hill." And then he told the senators and representatives before him what the first task was. He had not, it now turned out, accepted the wise, practical advice tendered at the Elms. First, he said, no memorial oration or eulogy could more eloquently honor President Kennedy's memory than the earliest possible passage of the Civil Rights Bill for which he fought so long. We have talked long enough in this country about equal rights. We have talked for 100 years or more. It is time now to write the next chapter and to write it in the books of law. Write it in the books of law. He had written civil rights into the books of law, written it twice, and his next words were a reminder of that. I urge you again, as I did in 1957 and again in 1960, to enact a civil rights law. The legislation he had been forced to settle for then in those years had been inadequate, and he admitted that, urging the legislators before him to enact this time a law that would eliminate from this nation every trace of discrimination and oppression that is based upon race or color. Later, in another speech, he would explain that if he hadn't been able to do more for civil rights before, the situation was different now. Referring to the brown-skinned children he had taught in Catullah, he would say, I never thought that I might have the chance to help the sons and daughters of those students, and people like them all over the country. But now I do have that chance. And I'll let you in on a secret. I mean to use it. Although he didn't make that personal explanation now in his first speech, he nonetheless got the point across. Before he had finished with his sentences on civil rights, the House chamber erupted in applause, the longest and loudest of his entire speech. Not everyone was applauding, of course, sitting in the second and third rows of seats directly behind the cabinet, since, as senior members of the Senate, they had led the procession of senators into the chamber and had been seated first in the Senate section, were two rows of Southern senators, Russell, Byrd, Eastland, Talmadge, Thurmond, and the rest, the men who had raised Lyndon Johnson to power in the Senate and had supported him for president, who had swallowed the 1957 and 1960 civil rights bills because, in addition, of course, to the fact that they were weak bills, of their belief that he'd be with them forever, that the civil rights bills he had passed and the civil rights speeches he had made were merely gestures he had had to make because of his presidential aspirations, that he was with us in his heart, and that the interests of the South, of segregation, could best be served by making him president. St. Augustine and Gettysburg had been, they believed, merely similar gestures, and they clung to that belief now. Herman Talmadge of Georgia, whom Johnson had spent hours and hours cultivating, who felt that Johnson viewed the relationship between whites and Negroes as master and slave, Talmadge, whom Johnson had assured so earnestly, I'm one of you, felt that Johnson was still one of them. Asked by the author of this book years later if his opinion had changed during that joint address on November 27th, he replied, not then, no. As for Russell, monumental as was his racism, it was no more monumental than his patriotism. An aura surrounded the presidency and the occupant of that office. Johnson had asked him the previous day to continue calling him Lyndon. Russell never again called him anything but Mr. President. With Russell, what's more, there was something harder to define, more poignant, something that had to do with the small apartment Richard Russell lived in alone, and the long evenings where his only companions were his books, something that had to do with the companionship of the younger man, and the dinners after work, you're going to have to eat somewhere, you know, at the Johnsons, and the brunches with the gentle wife and the two girls who called him Uncle Dick. And it had to do also with what it would mean to face the fact that he had raised to power a man who was committing himself to the destruction of the way of life he treasured. Nonetheless, they did not, of course, applaud. But while from those two rows and from the clusters of Southern representatives around the chamber there was no applause, these were islands of silence in a sea of cheers. He went on to the other tasks. Second, no act of ours could more fittingly continue the work of President Kennedy than the early passage of the tax bill for which he fought all this long year, he said. And he said there were the pending education bills, the pending foreign aid bill, the remaining appropriations bills. These were the tasks of Congress, he told them. He was a child of Congress, he told them. For 32 years, Capitol Hill has been my home, he said. He knew the right words to use with Congress. He couldn't do what he had to do without their help, he told them. An assassin's bullet has thrust upon me the awesome burden of the presidency. I am here today to say I need your help. I cannot bear this burden alone. What was needed from them was action. This nation has experienced a profound shock, and in this critical moment, it is our duty, yours and mine, as the government of the United States, to do away with uncertainty and doubt and delay, and to show that we are capable of decisive action. That from the brutal loss of our leader we will derive not weakness, but strength. That we can and will act, and act now. I firmly believe in the independence and the integrity of the legislative branch, and I promise you that I shall always respect this. It is deep in the marrow of my bones. But it was necessary for Congress to act, and to act quickly. The need is here. The need is now. I ask your help. There were words on hate. The time has come for Americans of all races and creeds and political beliefs to understand and to respect one another. So let us put an end to the teaching and the preaching of hate and evil and violence. And then there were the final lines of the speech, from a song. He spoke them in a very soft voice, very slowly, with so much emotion that his voice seemed on the verge of breaking. No one listening to those last lines would recall that Lyndon Johnson was not an eloquent speaker. America, America, God shed his grace on thee, Lyndon Johnson said, and crown thy good with brotherhood from sea to shining sea. Although the speech had been interrupted 31 times for applause, the applause had not come from everyone in the chamber. Republicans had not applauded many of his points, and the Southerners had applauded none that dealt with civil rights. But as Lyndon Johnson spoke those last words and closed his notebook and took off his glasses, the chamber, to the last man and woman in it, it seemed, rose to its feet and began clapping. And as Johnson walked off the dais and back up the center aisle, the applause didn't stop. It didn't stop until he had left the chamber. Yet it wasn't the applause that most forcefully struck some of the reporters watching the scene from the press gallery, but the tears. Everywhere you looked, Hugh sighed, he said, people were crying. The applause was echoed in the press. Newspapers across the United States and indeed the world used triumph and synonyms for that word to describe the speech. In the most important address of his life, Evans and Novak were to write, Johnson achieved a tour de force. And filled as it was with eloquent, memorable phrases, all I have I would have given gladly, the greatest leader, the foulest deed, let us continue. I cannot bear this burden alone. The power of Lyndon Johnson's first speech as president, his address before a joint session of the Congress on November 27, 1963, lay as much in the manner in which the words were delivered as in the words themselves. It was, Wicker wrote in the New York Times, the way the president spoke, the dramatic force of his delivery, that impressed a city long accustomed to thinking of Mr. Johnson as flamboyant. The awkward, bullying gesticulations, the upraised hand with the jabbing forefinger, the upraised arms with the clenched fists pounding the air, the off-putting delivery, alternating between ponderous and rushed, with shouting as the principal vocal means of emphasis that had characterized Lyndon Johnson's formal speeches during his decades in public office, were totally absent during the 27 minutes he had spoken to Congress. During the entire speech, his hands had lain flat on the lectern, moving only to turn the pages of the notebook. His only gesture, as the Times reported, was an occasional forward snap of his head to emphasize his points. There was no shouting. Several times his voice dropped almost to a whisper. At other times it rang out challengingly, the Times said, but never in a flamboyant way. And no rushing. Rather, the Washington Post said, the speech's most striking aspect was its delivery. Slow, solemn, measured. Missing totally were the excesses of speech so widely associated with his earlier career. The words used to describe him were unlike any words that had been used about him before. He had, the Boston Herald said, demonstrated a sense of the grandeur of language that we did not think was one of his talents. A headline in the New York Times said, Johnson emerges grave and strong. Analyzing the speech's impact, the Times' Washington bureau chief, James Reston, wrote that it would have been so easy in the emotion of the moment for him to have gone too far today, or being deeply moved to have choked on the lovely cry, America, America, at the end. But he was both bold and restrained. Trying to find words to praise him adequately, Reston gave him what was for the columnist his highest compliment. He sounded for all the world like Mr. Sam Rayburn today, ever so slow and serious, but with repressed emotion always behind the deep, strong Texas voice. Sitting in the rows of congressmen looking up at the House dais, Joe Kilgore, who had been so worried, could, he says, hardly believe what he was seeing. I had never seen him speak in public like this, he says, never. The discipline that Lyndon Johnson had imposed on himself within EOB 274, that he had imposed on himself for 5 days, had held firm in what was, for him, the most difficult setting of all. Beyond merely avoiding the mistakes of the past, moreover, he had, for this one speech at least, transformed himself into what the New York Times called an orator, and a remarkable one. The manner in which he spoke of his grief, the moving first line of the speech and the apparent sincerity and deep solemn emotion with which he delivered it, together with the many lines thereafter in which he spoke of John Kennedy, accomplished what may have been the most difficult feat of all, to convince even men and women who, long familiar with Johnson and his ambitions as well as with his ostracism by the Kennedys, had not been disposed to accept his sincerity. Perhaps no columnist fell more completely into that category than Mary McGrory, but, she wrote, no one doubted for a moment that he spoke nothing but the truth when he said, all I have I would have given gladly not to be standing here today. No man, regardless of his ambition or his drive, would have wanted to stand in Lyndon Johnson's shoes on Wednesday. Said Doris Fleeson, his grief was obvious for all to see, and his determination to continue and to push toward enactment Kennedy's policies had been convincing, too, because of the determination written on his face as well as in the pages of his notebook. He had wanted the speech to reassure the country about its government, to give it confidence in the continuity and stability of the government's policies, to make it feel that policies would not be suddenly changed, but would in fact continue unchanged. The speech had done that. President Johnson has seized the new frontier in an all-encompassing embrace under the slogan, Let us continue, Doris Fleeson wrote. And he had wanted to reassure the country about himself, to give the nation confidence in him, to show a people that had not elected him to the presidency that he was competent to handle the job, to demonstrate to a country that was worried, uncertain, anxious for someone to take the lead, to assume command, to provide direction, that it had someone to do that, a new leader to replace the old one. He had wanted to show the country that he was in charge, that he knew what to do and that he would do it. And the speech had done that, too. It had not been merely the words, the need is here, the need is now, we must act and act now, that had done it. It had been the determination with which the words were spoken, the determination and the air of command. The big head had swung slowly, deliberately back and forth as he spoke, traversing the ranks of faces below him, with the same air with which he had once looked around the Senate, an air that had once moved a reporter who covered the Senate to say, it was like he was saying, this is my turf. An air that made a watching nation feel not only that he knew what should be done, but that if Congress resisted, he knew how to get Congress to do it, and would get Congress to do it. As Lyndon Johnson's narrowed eyes, tightened lips, and jutting jaw filled the television screen with fierce resolve, no one could doubt his willingness to act and to triumph. Across the nation and around the world, Newsweek said, there was evident relief in the strength he showed. The speech reminded journalists and congressmen, moreover, that in fact he had, for 6 years, gotten Congress to do it, had made the Senate act, and not only act but take the initiative in governmental action, as no other senator in American history had done. Johnson, Reston wrote the next day, is something different in the congressional mind from Kennedy or Eisenhower or Truman. When he was majority leader, Reston wrote, he ran the place, and without his special magic and cunning, his urgent energy, and his bag of tricks and treats, nothing has quite seemed to run as well on Capitol Hill since he left. Johnson is, to use his own inelegant phrase, a gut fighter, and a parliamentary tactician with few equals. Congress did not always like him, often it hated him, but it never trifled with him. In trying to illustrate his meaning, Reston found an apt quotation. It came from Woodrow Wilson, who wrote, when you come into the presence of a leader of men, you know you have come into the presence of fire, that it is best not incautiously to touch that man, that there is something that makes it dangerous to cross him. Congress was going to be a lot less willing to cross Lyndon Johnson than it had been to cross John Kennedy, Reston wrote. President Kennedy had a way of seeing all sides of a question. President Johnson has a way of concentrating on his own side of a question. When a congressman disagreed with him, Reston wrote, Johnson will say, I know how you feel, but can I count on you? And when the thing is put that way, upstairs in the White House, with Lyndon's long arm on a man's shoulder, voting suddenly becomes slightly complicated. The tragedy of Kennedy's death had changed Washington, Reston wrote. He is very much on the memory and the conscience of the Congress. He apparently had to die to create a sympathetic atmosphere for his program. And in Johnson there was a man who could take advantage of that atmosphere. Between the tragedy and Johnson's abilities, Reston wrote, the mind and spirit of Washington have been transformed. Making the triumph even more dramatic was the fact that it was so unexpected. After an entire career, 3 decades, spent anxiously but unsuccessfully attempting to overcome his faults as a speechmaker, Lyndon Johnson had, in the most important speech of his career, overcome them completely. A headline over David Lawrence's column summed it up. Johnson's speech. He met the test. Before the speech, during the 5 days since Ken O'Donnell had told him he's gone, he had met other tests. Thrust without warning into a crisis with potentiality for disaster, he had risen to the occasion, to every occasion. And now, on what may have been for him the toughest occasion of all, he had risen again. The feeling of confidence in his administration and in him was, furthermore, described by journalists who had known him for years in words, or rather in a word, that demonstrated that it was not just a city, but a man who had, during crucial days, a crucial moment in American history, been transformed. To Chalmers Roberts of the Washington Post, watching him from the press gallery, the man below him, whom he had known for so long, all at once had established himself as the dominant personality in American life. Suddenly, Roberts wrote, below him, there stood Lyndon B. Johnson, President of the United States. President. The applause at the end of the speech was for the tradition he had summoned and so well embodied, and for the dead president whose programs he had taken as his own, Time magazine said. But there was another reason for the applause as well, Time added. The formidable and elusive majority leader of the United States Senate sounded like a president. Not a fluke of history, the Herald Tribune said, but a president. Chapter 17. The Warren Commission. And at last he was in the president's office. There hadn't even been an oval-shaped office in the White House until 1909, when one was built as part of William Howard Taft's expansion of the West Wing, and that one had been in a different part of the building. The room into which Johnson walked on Tuesday morning had been created only 29 years earlier by Franklin Roosevelt, who in 1934 had the president's office moved to the West Wing's southeast corner, from which it was easier to roll in his wheelchair to his living quarters in the mansion, and who, working with the architect Eric Gugler, designed the room himself. As soon as John Kennedy had left for Texas, it had been redecorated with a red carpet and red-trimmed white drapes, ordered as a surprise for her husband by Jackie Kennedy. When Lyndon Johnson walked into the room at 8:50 a.m. Tuesday, 2 white couches were still standing in front of the fireplace at one end of the room, along with lamp tables and a coffee table with a telephone console on it at the room's other end, in front of 3 tall windows. The American and presidential flags were still standing behind a desk, a large standard-issue government desk, bare except for another telephone console that had been brought in the night before, along with Johnson's big leather desk chair, his own rocking chair, a side table and a couple of chairs to put in front of the desk. Colonel Roberts had had these items moved in on Monday night, along with a bust of Franklin Roosevelt that Johnson had told her to bring, and framed photographs of Lady Bird, Linda, Lucy, and John Kennedy. But Kennedy's rocking chair, the Resolute desk, the coconut shells, and the ship models were gone, as were the naval paintings and the books. Noticing that there were not even any shades on the windows, Roberts had located a White House seamstress and had had her run some up. And Roberts had carried over two vases and put flowers in them, but without paintings on the walls or books on the shelves, there was nothing to soften the bareness of the long, curving white walls, newly painted and gleaming, except for a lone pair of sconces. The ornamentation of the room, an oval 35 feet 10 inches long and 29 wide at its widest point, with a ceiling rising in a gentle arch from a cornice 16 feet high, was restrained. The symbols of power in it, on the ceiling in plaster, the presidential seal, above French doors, classical pediments and representations of fasces, bundles of bound rods with an axe protruding that in ancient Rome symbolized a magistrate's authority, were muted, subtle, in low relief and painted to blend in with the ceiling and walls. The room was gracious and serene, the four doors leading out of it to other parts of the White House set flush into the walls so that closed, they didn't interrupt the wall's long, graceful curves, which were broken otherwise only by bookshelves set into them, and topped by graceful seashell designs. Through the French doors, one could glimpse a garden with a row of rose bushes along one side. Yet despite the restraint in its decoration, there was something about the room that made it seem special, somehow larger and more imposing than its dimensions, something dramatic, memorable, unforgettable, in fact. Its shape had something to do with that. So rare in America were oval rooms that on entering this one you felt immediately that you were in a place that was out of the ordinary. And with the four doors set flush into its walls, those walls curve in an unbroken sweep, imposing, powerful. The shape of the room somehow imprints itself on the consciousness. From the time it was first built, newspapers and magazines started referring to it not simply as the President's office, but more often as the Oval White House office, or the President's Oval Office in the White House. The silence inside it had something to do with it, too, with the glass in the windows and French doors layered 3 inches thick, thick enough in 1963 to stop an assassin's bullet. Few noises penetrated from outside. There is a particular intensity to the quietness in that oval room. And it is special because of the light that suffuses it. The artificial lighting set invisibly behind the cornice that rims the room is very bright, but artificial light is the least of it. At one end of the room, filling its southern curve, behind the President's desk, are three great windows, each 11.5 feet tall. In its eastern wall are the three tall French doors. On clear days, the room was bathed in light, sunshine pouring in through all this glass in a flood of light so brilliant that, together with the expanse of white walls, during the 29 years since the office had been built, the walls had always been white. It seemed as luminous and dramatic as a stage set. Because the room is an oval, furthermore, there are no corners in it, no shadows, no darker areas. Day or night, there was nothing to dim the brightness of the Oval Office of the White House. But the room seemed special mostly because of what had happened in it. History had happened in it. Franklin Roosevelt had sat at that desk in front of the flags and windows, bantering with reporters as he guided a nation through a Great Depression and a Great War, hidden below the desk his paralyzed legs. Harry Truman had stood behind the desk to announce Japan's surrender, had later placed on it the plaque that said, "The buck stops here." Television had made the nation familiar with the setting, the president at the desk, flags flanking him, as a grim-faced Eisenhower announced in 1957 that he was sending troops into Little Rock, or, smiling his wonderful smile, stood behind the desk bantering with the press corps. Or as Kennedy, sitting at the desk, told the nation about the missiles in Cuba, or leafed through papers while his little son peeked out of the desk's cubbyhole. The room had an aura of great events. And since the desks of all of the four presidents who had occupied it, Roosevelt, Truman, Eisenhower, Kennedy, had been placed at one end of the oval in front of the tall windows and the tall flags. Over 3 decades, the setting had become emblematic of the presidency. So familiar was it becoming by November 1963, thanks to Kennedy and television, that journalistic references to the office were changing, and, as with all things involving Kennedy and television, they were changing fast. The room was, in fact, well along the road to becoming simply the capitalized, iconic Oval Office, perhaps the most famous room on Earth. The aura wasn't misleading. In that room, history was just a button away. The telephone consoles on the desk and coffee table resembled ordinary telephone consoles, albeit with an unusually large number of buttons, 27, while 25 of the buttons were the customary transparent whitish buttons of the ordinary console. Two, however, were not. One was amber in color, the other red. Both were linked directly to the war room in the Pentagon and to the office of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Both were linked also to an Army switchboard and through it to the Secretaries of Defense and State, to the directors of certain crucial government agencies and to key members of the White House staff. And when a president pushed the red button, he would also be connected through the war room to Strategic Air Command bomber bases, to other military commanders, and to the heads of government of America's allies. When the red button was pushed, moreover, the president's telephone line would be scrambled electronically so that he could be understood only by men with a similar line on their desks. And on a late November day, like the day Lyndon Johnson took possession of the Oval Office, when the leaves were off the trees beyond the three tall windows, visible through the windows and the bare branches beyond was a reminder of history's ultimate prize. For beyond the windows and the branches was the great shining white marble pillar, the Washington Monument, towering over the Capitol as a symbol of a president who achieved immortality, as a reminder of what the man behind the desk can become, of what the stakes are for him now, of the prize he can win in history's great game for which he has at last a seat at the table. Lyndon Johnson had been in that room many times before, of course, many times with Roosevelt as a young congressman, two or three times with Truman, often with Eisenhower, and then with Kennedy, but always on the other side of the desk. He wasn't on the other side now. Sitting down behind it, he telephoned the Senate offices to order the desk he had used in his majority leader's office delivered, and then directed his secretaries to start placing calls. The first day and the next were devoted mostly to preparing his Wednesday speech to the joint session. But there was a major problem he hadn't addressed, and on Thursday he turned his attention to the investigation into his predecessor's murder. The problem of who was going to investigate the assassination and the assassin's murder had to be addressed, he knew. The atmosphere was poisonous and had to be cleared, for he was aware of the directions in which the poison might spread. Russia was not immune, he was to write in his memoirs. Neither was Cuba, neither was the state of Texas, neither was the new president of the United States. The rumors about Russian or Cuban involvement in a conspiracy, rumors being kept fresh every day with new reports, mostly false, of Oswald's connections to the two communist countries, had very dangerous implications, he felt, since if they got a head start, if suspicions mounted that Khrushchev or Castro was responsible for Kennedy's death, or if in Russia fears about America's suspicions and about the possibility that they might cause America to retaliate created a feeling that perhaps Russia should move first, they contained the seeds of escalation in an age in which escalation could mean annihilation. Jack Ruby had added fuel to the fire, he was to write. With that single shot, the outrage of a nation turned to skepticism and doubt. To heightened fears of conspiracy, international or not, that further unsettled a country to which he was trying to bring a feeling of calm and stability. Intensifying the sense of urgency was the fact that Congress was already busily circling around the bright lights in which any assassination investigation would be bathed. The House Un-American Activities Committee, which saw a communist under every bush, had already announced it would hold an investigation, as had the Senate Judiciary Committee, Chairman James Eastland, whose obsession with communists might, in other circumstances, have been a joke. If the Mississippi River flooded, Johnson himself had said, Eastland would say the niggers had caused it, helped out by communists. Vying for the limelight, as one account was to put it, other committees in both the Senate and the House were proposing their own investigations. Investigations with their inevitable attendant television cameras, leaks, baseless speculation, half-truths, and innuendo, more anxiety, more danger. In his attempts before Thursday to deal with this problem, however, Johnson had shown none of the sure-footedness with which he had dealt with the other problems that had confronted him since November 22nd. To cut off the congressional publicity hunt, a lot of television show, as he put it, in its infancy, he wanted the investigation carried out by some other entity, but his first suggestion, made after consultation with Abe Fortas on the evening of November 25th, the day of Kennedy's funeral, was that the entity be either the Federal Bureau of Investigation, which of course was already investigating, or a special Texas State Court of Inquiry, staffed only by Texans, that would be convened by the state's Attorney General, Wagner Carr. There were legal jurisdictional rationales for his suggestion. The murder of a president, or of the president's murderer, was, under criminal justice law, no different from other murders. They were not federal but state crimes, and prosecutable only under state, not federal law. And there were political rationales as well. Fortas was later to explain that he had advised Johnson against the formation of any special new national investigating body, such as a presidential commission, on the grounds that its formation would be counterproductive to the aim of tamping down suspicions of a broader conspiracy, since people would gather there was more to the murders than appeared on the surface. Therefore, he said, ordinary procedures, like the Texas Court of Inquiry and the FBI investigation, should be followed. Fortas was also leery of having Johnson appoint the investigating body, since that might raise suspicions among those who believed the president himself might have had a role in the conspiracy. Personal, subjective considerations figured in the decision as well. The state with the legal authority to investigate the murders was Texas, his state, its name already blackened by November 22nd and November 24th. To turn over that authority to an outside body would, Johnson felt, be an admission of the state's lack of competence to conduct the investigation. The reaction to Fortas's suggestion was predictably unenthusiastic. Deputy Attorney General Katzenbach told Fortas it would be a ghastly mistake. Explains one account, Texas justice was so tainted that any purely state verdict on what happened would not be credible. As for the FBI, liberals' distrust of that agency would undermine the credibility of any report it issued. Only a special national commission, composed of men of national prominence and respect, and endowed with broad investigating latitude, would command the necessary credibility. Johnson's first responses to that reaction were ones that would have been expected from the pre-November 22nd Lyndon Johnson. Anger, a refusal to change his mind, and a secretive move designed to ensure that his solution would be the one adopted. He quietly gave Carr his approval of the State Court of Inquiry proposal. Good idea, but purely a state matter. Can't say president asked for it, was the word Cliff Carter passed to the Texas Attorney General. And after Kennedy's funeral on Monday, Carr announced its formation. So were his next responses. Learning that the Washington Post was planning to run an editorial on Tuesday, calling for the creation of a national commission, he had Fortas telephone its two top editors to try to kill it, and he himself made three calls for the same purpose, to J. Edgar Hoover, asking him to use his contacts on the Post to explain that an investigation by a commission might expose FBI sources and methods, to the paper's publisher, Catherine Graham, and to Post columnist Joseph Alsup. During his conversation with Alsup, the calm cracked. For the first time in any call during this period that has been recorded, Johnson's voice rose as he railed against Bobby Kennedy's lawyers. They thought of the Blue Ribbon Commission first at Justice, and we just can't have them lobbying against the president when he makes these decisions. He was yelling into the phone as he said, "They lobbied me last night. I spent the day on it. I spent most of my day on this thing yesterday." and in describing the proposed commission he used the term that to any Texan was particularly pejorative. "We don't send in a bunch of carpetbaggers," he told Alsip. "It's the worst thing you could do right now. We don't want to be in a position of saying we have come into a state with some outsiders and have told them that their integrity is no good and that we're going to have some carpetbagger trials. We can't haul off people from Dallas and try them in New York. It's their constitutional right." But while after those calls the Post did tone down its editorial, it no longer mentioned a presidential commission, it nonetheless still said that "no state or local inquiry will meet the situation in view of the dreadful record of justice miscarried that already has been made, and that the inquiry must be prosecuted by the federal government." And outside Texas, almost no one was buying the Texas Court of Inquiry proposal. The reaction of newspapers across the country to its formation was generally scathing. And 2 days later, Johnson reversed his course. On Friday, November 29th, he created by Executive Order Number 11130 a Special President's Commission on the Assassination of President John F. Kennedy. A 7-member bipartisan body, 5 of its members, in fact, were Republicans, to satisfy itself that the truth is known as far as it can be discovered, and to report its findings and conclusions to him, the American people, and the world. His order gave the commission powers so broad that they superseded all other inquiries, including those by the FBI or any state agency. In forming his commission, Lyndon Johnson displayed another of the qualities that had made him, to men and women who had worked for him over the years, a figure who inspired not only fear and respect, but awe. His ability that had led to his reputation as the greatest salesman one-on-one to persuade someone to do something he didn't want to do. To do something, in fact, that the person had been determined not to do. The purpose of the commission was to reassure the country, so he felt its members must be public figures whose very presence on it would be reassuring, men, in his phrase, known to be beyond pressure and above suspicion. When, in response to his request, Robert Kennedy suggested 2 names, former CIA Director Alan Dulles and a longtime advisor to presidents John J. McCloy, both of them Republicans, Johnson made them 2 of the 7, along with 3 respected Capitol Hill figures, Senator John Sherman Cooper of Kentucky, a Republican, and from the House, Democratic Whip Hale Boggs of Louisiana, and Republican Gerald R. Ford, Jr. of Michigan, a young representative who had risen fast in the House hierarchy. But it was the 2 other men he wanted to appoint whose presence on the commission he considered indispensable. Its chairman had to be not only a Republican, he was to say, but a Republican whose judicial ability and fairness were unquestioned. Although he had only a passing acquaintance with Earl Warren, Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court, we had never spent 10 minutes alone together. To me, he was the personification of justice and fairness. As for the other man whose presence Johnson considered essential, he was less well-known nationally than the Chief Justice. But to Capitol Hill, Richard Russell personified, in every area but race, similar attributes, and if the commission's investigation and subsequent report should prove to be controversial, his unrivaled power there would be an effective means of keeping the controversy under control. Johnson may have been remembering, too, another investigation, one that had taken place at a time when America had been as close to a state of national hysteria as it had ever been before in its history. A crisis that, in its challenge to civilian authority over the military, had threatened constitutional upheaval. The controversy that had erupted in 1951 over President Truman's firing of Douglas MacArthur. Johnson, then a junior senator, had observed how his seniors, even those most avid for publicity, had shrunk from the responsibility of chairing Senate hearings on MacArthur, had seen how, in a time of crisis, even though the Senate's militant liberals generally regarded Russell as the enemy, that did not prevent them from running to him for shelter. And Johnson had witnessed the results, how the calmness and patience with which Russell conducted months of hearings, firmness, fairness, and dignity that Life magazine said was almost unmatched in recent congressional history, had taught the country that things were more complicated than they had seemed, calming its passions in what one historian called a demonstration of what the Senate at its best was capable of doing. The intervening 12 years had done nothing to diminish the reputation of the Georgia giant. When, during their discussions of the executive order, Johnson told Fortas he wanted Russell on the commission, the lawyer, normally reserved, burst out, "Oh, I would too, yes, sir. I'd rather have him than most anybody for anything." He hadn't mentioned Russell's name himself, Fortas said, only because I thought it would be foreordained. A further consideration was that a president appointing a commission or committee to investigate a controversial issue wants to have an ally on it, someone he can trust, a member who will quietly keep him informed about the investigation's course and its findings, and about the conclusions of the report the panel is likely to issue, so that, if necessary, there can be intervention to effect an alteration in course or a change in emphasis in the report, a member who would be, in the political parlance of the day, the president's man on the panel. Richard Russell, of course, would never be anyone's man on anything, yet he and Johnson had over the years quietly worked hand in glove on so many sensitive issues, and for similar aims, on most questions, almost all really that did not involve race, their views were very much alike. That the quiet rapport between them was an established element of their relationship. Private discussions of the commission's work would be only normal for them. Nor were these the only reasons he wanted Russell on the commission. There was only one head of the table at which the Southern caucus met. Wherever Richard Russell sat, the Southern senators, so many of them powerful in their own right, looked to him for guidance on many issues and followed his lead all but automatically. On racial issues, on the great civil rights fight to come, he and Russell would be unalterably opposed, but there would be other issues. The more of them on which he could make Russell an ally, strategizing and persuading together as they had in the past, the easier things would go for him in the Senate. There was, however, a problem. Warren and Russell were both very strong-minded men, and neither wanted to serve on a commission investigating the assassination. Indeed, each of them had made up his mind not to do so. Warren had strongly held views about Supreme Court justices serving on what he called extrajudicial bodies. No justice, he felt, should ever do so. Every time that precept had been violated, he felt, the results had been unfortunate. The service of 5 justices on the commission investigating the Hayes-Tilden election of 1876 had, he was to write, demeaned the court. The appointment of Justice Owen Roberts as chairman of the Presidential Commission investigating Pearl Harbor, and the resulting criticism of that commission's report, had tarnished the court's august image, and he had several other examples to prove his point. During his tenure as Chief Justice, in fact, the justices had discussed the question, and "I was sure that every member of the court was of the opinion that such appointments were not in its best interest." The formation of a presidential commission now was undoubtedly necessary, he felt. To have several congressional investigations going on at once would have been chaos. But he was not going to serve on it. When, at Johnson's request, Deputy Attorney General Katzenbach and Solicitor General Archibald Cox called on him in the court at 2:30 in the afternoon of November 29th to sound him out about accepting the chairmanship, he told them, he was to recall, that "I thought the president was wise in having such a commission, but that I was not available for service on it." He told the 2 men to tell the president that if he was asked to serve, he would refuse, and, he says, "I considered the matter closed." As for Russell, one of his reasons, the emphysema that was draining his energy so that he worried with reason that he was not fulfilling his Senate responsibilities as he once had, was poignant. When Johnson telephoned him at his home in Winder that afternoon and asked him to serve on the commission, Russell's reply was, "Oh, no, no, get somebody else now. I haven't got time." His health simply wouldn't permit him to assume any new duties, he said. "Not being appointed would save my life, I declare. I don't want to serve on that committee." Johnson didn't press the point because the call had other purposes. To conceal from Russell, at least for the moment, any connection between the commission on which he was being asked to serve and the 2 men whom Russell distrusted above all others in public life, one of whom, Robert Kennedy, Johnson had allowed to name 2 members of the commission, the other of whom, the man who had led the Warren Court to foist the Brown decision on the South, he wanted to be its chairman. The concealment required an outright falsehood. During the call, Russell asked Johnson, "Now you are going to let the Attorney General nominate someone, aren't you?" Johnson's reply was, "No, uh-uh." Although, of course, he not only had asked Robert Kennedy to nominate someone, but had already accepted both his nominees, Dulles and McCloy. On another point, there was, if not falsehood, indirection. During his conversation with Russell, Johnson had said to Moyers, "Bill, give me that list of people," he was considering so that he could read it to Russell, "to get your reaction to it." But he read only 6 of the 7 names on the list. He didn't read the 7th name, the one that in fact headed the list. Throughout the long rambling call, Johnson never revealed that Warren was being actively considered for membership on the commission, let alone for its chairmanship. The closest he came was to say that for the 7th member he was considering maybe somebody from the Supreme Court. At one point he dropped a hint, asking Russell, "Who would be the best one if I didn't get the chief?" But his next words obscured it. He understood that none of the court would want to serve because of the past history of justices in non-judicial roles, he said. And he said, "That's why he's, Warren, against it now." And there were other words to obscure it. Since he didn't think any member of the Supreme Court would accept an appointment to the commission, he brought up the possibility of naming a judge from a lower court, even asking Russell's opinion of several. The call ended with Russell saying that he was sure Johnson could get the name of some outstanding circuit court judge, and Johnson saying, "Okay, you be thinking." Russell, too, assumed his refusal had closed the matter. But Lyndon Johnson never took no for an answer, and he wasn't going to take no now. As soon as he was informed of Warren's refusal to serve, he telephoned the Chief Justice and invited him to the Oval Office. Warren, a man of great determination, may have been determined not to serve, but when he arrived, as he was to recall, there were only the two of us in the room. Lyndon Johnson had him one-on-one. The Chief Justice may have believed that there were no words that could move him, but Johnson found some. Reminding Warren that he had served in the Army during World War I, the President said he was sure that if he asked him to put on his uniform again, he would do it, and you'd go fight if you thought you could save one American life. It wasn't just one American life that might be involved now, Lyndon Johnson said. It was 39 million. If Khrushchev moved on us, he could kill 39 million in an hour. And these wild people are charging Khrushchev killed Kennedy and Castro killed Kennedy and everybody else killed Kennedy. And if Khrushchev felt threatened because of what these rumors might cause America to do, he just might move on us. And all I want you to do is look at the facts and bring any other facts that you want in here and determine who killed the president and end the rumors, Lyndon Johnson said. But here I'm asking you to do something and you're saying no when you could be speaking for 39 million people. Now I'm surprised that you, the Chief Justice of the United States, would turn me down. Tears came to Warren's eyes, Johnson was to write in his memoirs. Warren does not confirm that in his, merely writing that he said, "Mr. President, if the situation is that serious, my personal views do not count. I will do it." Then, says Warren, he thanked me and I left the White House. It hadn't even taken that long, according to the White House log, 22 minutes at most. It's possible to make a sale quickly, even a very big sale, if the salesman is good enough. That left Russell. Johnson had had to do a quick reading of Warren. He had had years to read Richard Brevard Russell, and he had read him all the way through. Russell may have thought his refusal to serve on the commission had ended the matter, but a few minutes after Johnson had put down the receiver at the end of his call to Winder, he picked it up again to call Everett Dirksen and tell him the names of the panel's members, and Russell was one of the names. "He didn't want to take it, but he will," Johnson said. "I'm going to make him do it." And he knew how to make him do it. He had Pierre Salinger type up and hand to the White House press corps a press release announcing the formation of the commission and the names of the 7 people he had appointed to it. And Russell's name was one of the 7. He waited a while because he didn't want Russell to know about the announcement until newspapers had set it in type and until presses were rolling with the next day's editions. Then, at 8:55 that evening, he had the White House operators put in another call to Winder. When Richard Russell picked up the phone, he was in a good mood. When Johnson said, "Dick, I hate to bother you again, but..." he interrupted his caller to say in a friendly tone, "That's all right, Mr. President." But that mood didn't last long. "I wanted you to know that I'd made the announcement," Johnson said. "Announcement of what?" Russell asked in a puzzled tone. Johnson read him the text of the press release. "The members are Chief Justice Earl Warren, Chairman, Senator Richard Russell, Georgia." Russell protested, "Well now, Mr. President, I just can't serve on that commission. I couldn't serve there with Chief Justice Warren. I don't like that man. I don't have any confidence in him." "Ah, Dick," Johnson said, "it's already been announced. It's already done. It's been announced." In an astonished tone of voice, Russell said, "You mean you've given that?" "Yes, sir. I mean I gave it. I gave the announcement, and it's already in the papers, and you're on it." Russell didn't go quietly. "Mr. President, you ought to have told me you were going to name Warren," he said. And when Johnson said, I told you today I was going to name the Chief Justice when I called you," Russell refused to let that misrepresentation stand. "No, you did not," he said. "You were talking about getting somebody on the Supreme Court. You didn't tell me that you were going to name him." But the arguments Johnson used on Russell, and their effect on Russell, showed how deeply he had read into the text. He used the arguments he had used with Warren in very much the same words, because Russell, too, had served in the armed forces. "We've got to take this out of the arena when they're testifying that Khrushchev and Castro did this and did that, and that kicking us into a war that can kill 40 million Americans in an hour, and you put on your uniform in a minute." And when at first they proved less effective than they had with the Chief Justice, he appealed to the motivation that always worked most effectively with Russell, his patriotism and sense of duty, telling him that he might not want to serve with Warren, but you can do anything for your country. "And don't go to giving me that kind of stuff about you can't serve with anybody. You can do anything." "You never turned your country down," Lyndon Johnson told Richard Russell. "This is not for me. This is for your country." There was, furthermore, a new tone, a tone of command, as if to remind Russell that it was not just Lyndon Johnson talking now, but the president. When Russell continued to protest, the Texas twang rode over the Georgia drawl. "You're my man on that commission, and you are going to do it. And don't tell me what you can do and what you can't, because I can't arrest you, and I'm not going to put the FBI on you. But you're goddamn sure you're going to serve, I'll tell you that." And when Russell continued to balk, "I think you're sort of taking advantage of me, Mr. President," the attack switched from the patriotic to the personal. "I'm going to take a hell of a lot of advantage of you, my friend, because you made me, and I know it, and I don't ever forget. I'll be taking advantage of you a good deal," Johnson said. "I'm a Russell protege, and I don't forget my friends." The childless Russell was paternally fond of his nephew, Robert E. Lee Russell, Jr., and Johnson had over the years invested time in making a friend of Bobby Russell, and he brought his name in. "You are going to do what's right, and if you can't do it, you get that damned little Bobby up there and let him twist your tail and put a cockle burr under it." There was a hint of the possibility of a federal appointment. "Where is he?" Johnson asked. "You just tell him to get ready, because I'm going to need him." The conversation continued, for the senator received a much harder sell than the Chief Justice. And although there were signs that Russell was weakening, Johnson still didn't have him. "I don't know when I've been as unhappy about a thing as I am this." "This is awful," Russell said. "I can't do it," he said. "I haven't got the time." When Johnson said, "I don't want to beg you, by God, to serve," Russell replied, "I know, but this is a sort of rough one now." It had been essential to stop the other investigations, Johnson said to Russell, and his use of Russell's name had done that. "Jim Eastland, he said this is the best thing that ever happened." Before Russell's name was invoked, they had a full-scale investigation going, Dick, with the TV up there. He had had no choice but to appoint him, Lyndon Johnson said, and his voice dropped to the earnest, deferential tone of a protege talking to the old master. How else could he have stopped the congressional circus that would have been so harmful to America? Lyndon Johnson asked Richard Russell. How do I stop it? How do I stop it, Dick? Now don't tell me that I've worked all day and done wrong. And that last twist did the trick. I didn't say you'd done wrong, Richard Russell said. If it is for the good of the country, you know damned well I'll do it. And I'll do it for you, for that matter. And when, despite this remark, an instant later Russell was still expressing reservations, so that Johnson still could not be certain that his acceptance was final, Johnson resumed the tone, reminding Russell of a very intimate and significant moment in their relationship. Dick, he said, do you remember when you met me at the Carlton Hotel for breakfast in 1952? When we had breakfast there one morning and I became leader? Yes, I think I do, Russell said. No one can be certain of what was said at the breakfast, but it had occurred on November 9, 1952, a week after the elections in which the Senate Democratic leader, Ernest McFarland of Arizona, had lost his Senate seat. Russell could have had the leadership for the asking, but as had always been the case, he didn't want it. And during that week, he had several conversations with Johnson, who did, and in one of them, reported Evans and Novak, who interviewed both men that month, Russell suggested that Johnson should take the job, and Johnson's reply was that he would do so, on condition that Russell would change his desk in the Senate chamber so that he would be sitting directly behind the leader's desk. He needed Russell close to him, Johnson said, because he would be constantly asking for his guidance. Now, in this November 1963 call, he was saying that he still needed Russell, that that was why he had appointed him to the commission. "Do you think I'm kidding you?" Lyndon Johnson asked. Over the telephone line from Winder, heard clearly in the recording of this conversation, came a chuckle from the old senator, amused, fond. "No, I don't think you're kidding me," Richard Russell said. And the bottom line was the ineluctable fact. The announcement of Russell's appointment to the commission had already been made, was already public knowledge. And therefore Russell's refusal to accept it would be not merely a quiet refusal, but a public rejection of an assignment that the president considered important to the country. A slap in the president's face from a man who revered the institution of the presidency, and a public slap as well in the face of a man with whom he had worked for so many years, and who was indeed his protege. A slap in the face of a man with whose wife and family he had spent so much time. "If you hadn't announced it, I would absolutely have refused it," Russell said, quite firmly. "Yes, I would." But Johnson's announcement had left him no choice, and he knew it. "I'm not going to say any more, Mr. President, because I'm at your command, and I'll do anything you want," he said. "I hope to God you'll be just a little bit more deliberate and considerate next time. But this time, of course, if you've done this, I'm going to do it and go through with it, and say I think it's a wonderful idea." "Well, you are damn sure going to be at my command. You aren't going to be at my command as long as I'm here," Johnson said. And worked up, revved up by this time, he didn't stop escalating his appeals even after Russell's surrender. "I don't give a damn if you have to serve with a Republican, if you have to serve with a communist, if you have to serve with a Negro, if you have to serve with a thug, you're going to serve," he said. And then switched abruptly to the personal again. "No one has ever been more to me than you have, Dick, except my mother," he said. "I bothered you more and made you spend more hours with me telling me what was right and wrong than anybody except my mother." Was mother insufficient? A man had, after all, two parents. "I haven't got any daddy, and you're going to be it," he said. Richard Russell laughed, although the man who hated the Warren Court was now a member of the Warren Commission. The formation of the commission was greeted with an overwhelming chorus of praise for both its mandate and its membership. The huge headlines in the Republican Herald Tribune might have been written by Johnson himself. "Warren heads President's panel," they said. "Its purpose, to reveal every fact." The commission's membership represents a broad power structure cutting across party and executive lines, the Herald Tribune said. It includes leading figures ranging from Mr. McCloy to Ford, a leading congressional Republican, In Mr. Dulles, the President has selected one of the most famous intelligence experts in U.S. espionage history. And the inclusion of the two men Johnson considered key had the effect he wanted. Almost immediately, the body became known as the Warren Commission, and with the announcement that Russell was on the investigating panel, talk of other congressional investigations quickly died away. Although it had taken a few days for Johnson to understand that the Texas course on which he had originally been insisting was misdirected, when he did, he demonstrated on the new course the same sureness of touch he had been exhibiting in other areas. He had come to the presidency with an understanding of the need to build confidence and of the need, as a crucial element in accomplishing that end, to end skepticism and doubt about the assassination, particularly because of the possibility, in that Cold War era, of doubts escalating into disaster. Far-fetched? Not more so than a Balkan bullet leading to a world conflagration. And with the appointment of the Warren Commission, he may have felt, and for a time the country felt, he'd accomplished that end. The widespread praise for its creation was echoed 10 months later by the reaction when it issued its report, which found that a single gunman, Oswald, was responsible for the assassination of John F. Kennedy, that no conspiracy was involved either by the Soviet Union or Cuba or anyone else. Before the Warren Commission's report, only 29% of the American public had believed Oswald had acted alone. A poll taken shortly after the report's release showed that that percentage had risen to 87%. That confidence would not last for long, in part because of the discovery of gaps in the Commission's work, in part because of a flood of books, a flood that has continued to this day, that claimed to have discovered evidence of conspiracies involving, among others, the CIA, the Mafia, and Lyndon Johnson himself. A House Representatives Select Committee that was established in 1976 to restudy the assassination did little to resolve the controversies. Its report, released in 1979, concluded that John Kennedy was probably assassinated as a result of a conspiracy. But while it ruled out the Soviet Union or Cuba as the origin of this conspiracy, it said it was unable to identify who had been involved in it. By 1983, 75% of Americans disbelieved the lone gunman theory and felt a conspiracy was involved, and the percentage has held relatively steady in polls taken since. In no poll was there consensus about the conspiracy's origin or members. In a 2003 Gallup poll, 18% of Americans felt Lyndon Johnson was indeed involved. Since that time, more books as well as television programs have put that theory forward. However, as I've said earlier, nothing that I found in my research leads me to believe that, whatever the full story of the assassination may be, Lyndon Johnson had anything to do with it. At the time, the crucial weeks and months following the assassination, the formation of the commission accomplished its purpose. The fact that the crime was being investigated by a commission of men with reputations for integrity, that its chairman was a public figure with a uniquely high reputation for integrity, and that its report initially was greeted with respect, helped calm America's unease over the assassination of its president. The Warren Commission brought us through a very critical time in our history, Lyndon Johnson would write in his memoirs. I believe it is fair to say that the commission was dispassionate and just. The second sentence in that statement would not, if evaluated at the time this book is published, enjoy universal acceptance, but the first sentence should. And the country had been brought through that critical time, that crisis in the national history, those initial days and weeks after the assassination, in which anxiety about conspiracies could have escalated, because of Lyndon Johnson's decision to create the Warren Commission. It was a difficult decision for him to make. It went against his nature, against his desire, his need for control, and for the secrecy which is a form of control. Control and secrecy that he would have had, had he insisted that the investigation into the assassination be made by a Texas court of inquiry that was under his thumb, and by an FBI headed by a longtime ally. But he made that decision, sacrificed control and secrecy, and, moreover, turned over the investigation to a man he hardly knew and whose independence was already a legend when, that Friday afternoon, he asked Dura Warren to come to the Oval Office. It was not his speech to Congress alone that had demonstrated, in these early days, that Lyndon Johnson was not a fluke of history, but a president.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.